putting a cap on our lessons on fallacy detection. Today on Principles and Policies. Hello, I'm your host for today, Chuck Michaelis, Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. Barry Sheets is not with me today in studio, but you will hear his voice on the following recording. And that's because this recording is the end to a little overly long section of a recording we did this week. And it was long enough that we decided to make a show out of it. What it is, it's the end of our lessons on doing informal fallacy detection, what we call our baloney detector. So without further ado, we will finish up the lesson.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that's the thing. We're always going to caution you to be discerning. Don't take our word for it. Don't even take one survey's word for it. Do some research. You know what? We got a great tool now. It's called the internet. Everybody can get on one. If you don't know one, you can go to your local library and get on one. Google up these candidates' names and Google up surveys or questionnaire responses and take a look at how they respond. There are numerous groups all over the country that aggregate the survey responses of candidates. As a matter of fact, I'll share a little. The part of the reason that they do that is because a lot of times this information is hard to find otherwise. And sometimes you'll have candidates that will answer one group survey one way and answer another's the other way. As a matter of fact, I had a little, just for an analogy today, I was talking with a political operative who shall remain nameless, who was very concerned about whether certain groups were going to allow the surveys that they were giving candidates to be public. God bless them. I understand what their concern is.
Yes.
But you know what? I also understand what my concern is with that as well. And so in the interest of keeping the guilty parties nameless, I'm not going to say who it was or who I was talking to, but I had to stifle a laugh because I understand what's going on with this, because what they're really concerned about is candidates that they know will not answer surveys well. And then not only will the groups who are surveying it be opposing that candidate, but other groups out there will use those survey results to come after the candidate. But honestly, if they're bad on the issue, maybe they should have to take some heat.
Let's circle back around, Barry. This brings us back to our point that we've been making for the last three shows, and that is be a discerning reader, listener, and voter.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to run out of time, so what I want to do is I want to go circle back because we have one more clip that I want to do.
I want to get to this clip.
And this clip is fun. We've already listened to it. But the fact is that in that last little section, you heard all the talking. He went back to the attempted Times Square bombing and Anwar al-Awlaki and the Christmas underwear bomber and the shoe bomber and all these fellows. What fallacy did you hear in that, Barry? Because I heard one definitely.
Well, guilt by association.
That's part of it. But that's where he was really going with that, was an appeal to fear.
Well, that as well.
He was an appeal to fear because these people would have, you know, he would have blown up a plane with all these people on it. Well, that's been going on now since, 1970 or 1969.
Well, you know what's interesting, Chuck? Of all of those examples, except for Anwar al-Awlaki, the underwear bomber, the Times Square bombing, the bombing of the Twin Towers earlier on, were all done by foreign nationals. They weren't done by American citizens.
The underwear bomber was a citizen.
Richard Reed was a citizen. That's the shoe bomber. Excuse me. I apologize.
Yeah, I'm taking
back.
Yeah,
Richard Reed was a citizen of Britain.
I think that's right.
He was British.
That's right. And in fact, it points us back to where the real problem is. The government wants it two ways. They want to use the bad immigration policy that they have used to essentially erase our borders in order to, quote unquote, make it fair for all those illegal immigrants who are here basically with malicious intent. We have to surrender our rights in order so those people can't attack us. No, I think we need to gather them up and give them a collective boot print on their behinds as they go out the door and say, don't come back. And here's one of the things that people just don't really seem to realize is that a lot of these people are sneaking through places like the Mexican border.
Well, even worse, Chuck, they're sneaking through areas where nobody would expect them to sneak through. The Canadian border.
The Canadian border, oh sure. Because and that's been a problem for years because the Canadians had good relations with the Chinese and the Cubans when we had no relations with them, and we had Chinese and Cuban agents coming over here all that time. They just check into Cuba, and let's face it, it's the longest unprotected border in the world, and the Canadians are our friends, and don't take this wrong, but the fact is that they had relations with some bad players. And those relations were taken advantage of to get people into the United States.
But with all that said, it still doesn't rise to the level of Congressman Dent's proposed legislation to strip people of their American citizenship based upon subjective processes that are still mainly undefined in the legislation.
Okay, just to be clear, what he said about American citizenship there was an equivocation. He used the equivocation fallacy because he basically made citizenship into something that it is not, something that you can have stripped from you, a right. And he took an inalienable right and made it, he is attempting to make it alienable.
Right. He wanted to change it from a right to a responsibility, which means if you're being irresponsible, you can have it taken away from you like some bad child.
And a privilege.
That's, yes.
And a privilege. Okay, we've pretty much torn that to pieces. We haven't hit all the little minor details. But the fact is, we're going to call up another audio here.
Bridget joins us now. Bridget, overall, how did today compare to yesterday?
The biggest surprise of today was definitely gold. It was down about $100 an ounce. That represents the biggest two-day drop in 28 years. There's a couple of things going on today. Some investors were selling off their gold holdings to try to make up for losses in other areas. But Todd Hirsch says there's something else happening here, too. Some investors aren't confident that with what gold is backed by, or if it's backed by anything at all, as compared to something like the U.S. dollar. Investors are comfortable that the U.S. dollar is backed by the American government, so no matter what is happening to the American economy, something like the U.S. dollar is backed by the Federal Reserve. That's going to be around a year from now. That's a much more comfortable investment for them. Tara. Right.
Thank you, Bridget.
Okay, Barry.
Where do we begin?
Yeah,
this one, Chuck, you when I first heard this, I was laughing out loud because, you know, okay, let's just go with this. First of all, the whole point is that gold had the biggest two-day drop in 28 years. Okay, so what? It's still over $1,600 an ounce, and I'm not seeing how I could put an ounce of American currency on the table and get you much more value.
Well, here's what answers what she said. Let's take an ounce of the American government and put it on a scale, and an ounce of gold and put it on a scale, and which one's worth more?
Obviously, it's going to be the ounce of gold.
Yes, because there is no such thing as an ounce of the American government.
That's right.
American government is a concept.
Yes, it is.
This is a little abstract, but the fact is the American government is a concept. It is not a physical thing. Now, it has physical manifestations, obviously Washington, D.C., the Capitol building, the White House.
535 Congress critters and a guy running around acting like he's the president. Yeah.
An umpteen quadrillion bureaucrats who are
eating out our substance.
Yeah. But the fact is, there is no such thing as an ounce of American government. It has no intrinsic value, but gold does. Gold has an intrinsic value, and intrinsic means it is a property of it, that it has value.
That's right.
It's a rare metal. It has been used as a currency for 6,000 years. Now, that little speech she gave about, well, you know, the American government will be there next year. Gold has been here for about 5,800 years longer
than the American government.
And gold will continue to be here long after the American government is in the dustbin of history.
Well, and this is the other thing that got me. You talk about equivocation fallacy. Boy, there was a big one in here, because if you listen carefully to that young lady, you know, she first said that the U.S. dollar was more stable because it was backed by the American government.
Right.
And then she took a breath and kept going, and then she reiterated that statement by saying that the U.S. currency is backed by the Federal Reserve. So, in other words, she equivocated the Federal Reserve system with the American government. Now, if you know anything about the Federal Reserve system, it's a private entity.
That's right.
Oh, it would only be quasi-governmental in any respect whatsoever. But the point is that just like the American government, the Federal Reserve system doesn't have any intrinsic value.
That's right. In fact, it's a drag on the economy.
It exactly
is. On the actual things that do have intrinsic value. It's like gasoline. Gasoline has an intrinsic value, and the price goes up and down with the value of the dollar.
Yeah, well, let's look at it this way, Chuck. I think just to make it simple for our listeners, if I threw an ounce of gold on the table and a packet of Federal Reserve notes on the table, which one do you think the average person is going to pick up if I told them they could only have one?
Guess what? I take the ounce of
they're
gold.
They're going to go with the gold, baby. That's okay. You know it.
For the last couple of weeks, Barry and I have been talking to you about the National Defense Authorization Act and what a really, truly dangerous piece of legislation it is. It turns out now that we have a presidential candidate who has declared that he would have signed it in a recent debate, and we have a presidential candidate who has not only said he would have vetoed it, but is doing something actively about getting the bad passages that would allow you to be, as an American citizen, to be detained and held without trial or tried by a military tribunal out of that bill. Now, the first one, unfortunately, was Rick Santorum, who said he would have happily signed the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and Ron Paul, who is entering a bill in Congress to have those portions of the law stripped out. Without further ado, I'm going to offer up Congressman Paul's speech on the floor of the House so you can decide for yourself whether this is something that's good or not, and you can also use your baloney detector to see if you find anything in there that's false. I was unable to.
Chair recognizes the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Paul, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I rise today to introduce a very simple piece of legislation to repeal the infamous Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, quietly signed into law by the President on New Year's Day. What a way to usher in the new year. Section 1021 essentially codifies into law the very dubious claim of presidential authority under 2001 authorization for the use of military force to indefinitely detain American citizens without access to legal representation or due process of law. Section 1021 provides for the possibility of the U.S. military acting as a kind of police force on U.S. soil, apprehending terror suspects, including Americans, and whisking them off to an undisclosed location indefinitely. No right to attorney, no right to trial, no day in court. This is precisely the kind of egregious distortion of justice that Americans have always ridiculed in so many dictatorships overseas. A great man named Solzhenitsyn became the hero of so many of us when he exposed the Soviet Union's extensive gulag system. Is this really the kind of a United States we want to create in name of fighting terrorism? Some have argued that nothing in Section 1021 explicitly mandates holding Americans without trial, but it employs vague language, radically expanding the detention authority to include anyone who has substantially supported certain terrorist groups or associated forces. No one has defined what those terms mean. What is an associated force? Sadly, too many of my colleagues are too willing to undermine our Constitution to support such outrageous legislation. One senator even said about American citizens being picked up under this section of the NDAA, quote, "When they say, I want a lawyer, you tell them, shut up. You don't get a lawyer," close quote. Is this acceptable in someone who has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution? Mr. Speaker, of course, I recognize how critical it is that we identify and apprehend those who are suspected of plotting attacks against Americans. But why do we have so little faith in our judicial system? Have we not tried in civilian court and won convictions of hundreds of individuals for terrorist or related activities? I fully support continuing to do so. But let us not abandon what is so unique and special about our system of government in the process. I hope my colleagues will join my effort to overturn this shameful Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. And I yield back.
And we'd like to hear your opinion on what you just heard. So come out to our website, www.principledpolicy.com. and send us an email, leave a comment on the comm box on the podcast here, and we invite you to join us again next week for more principles and policies.